So, I want you to imagine you are staring at just a completely chaotic world.
Which, I mean, isn't too hard to do these days.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But imagine you are trying to find like the ultimate blueprint for how things survive in that chaos.
And not just scrape by, right?
No, exactly. Not just scraping by.
Right,
I
yeah.
mean, how things actually thrive, how they adapt, basically how they fundamentally make sense of a universe that honestly seems hell-bent on tearing them apart.
Yeah, entropy is always winning in the end.
Right. And usually when we think about survival, we instinctively categorize it. We put, biological survival in one
Like
box.
a single immune cell fighting off a toxin.
Yeah, exactly. And then we put, say, relationship survival in a completely different box.
Right, like visualizing a couple sitting in a therapist's office.
Trying to
Okay.
salvage their marriage, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we put global financial markets or like the fragile ecosystem of a coral reef in totally separate boxes too.
With entirely different sets of rules for each one.
Exactly. We expect reality to be fragmented because, well, I mean, that is how we were taught to study it.
It does feel comforting to have different sciences for different scales. Like,
Yeah.
we rely on biology to explain the cell, right?
Right.
And psychology to explain the marriage, economics for the market. It keeps the world neatly partitioned.
Which makes it way easier for our brains to
It
process.
does. But, you know, that partitioning might actually be the very thing blinding us to the bigger picture.
Yeah, and that's the big question here. What if those partitions are just a complete illusion?
Right.
What if that single immune cell, the struggling marriage, the crashing financial market, and the dying coral reef all share literally the exact same underlying architecture?
I mean, if you can actually identify an underlying grammar that applies across all those domains, you
Yeah.
aren't just looking at isolated systems anymore.
No, you're not.
You are looking at the fundamental mechanics of viability itself. And that is, I mean, that's the definition of a paradigm shift.
Which brings us to the mission of our deep dive today. We are unpacking this massively ambitious transdisciplinary monograph.
It was published in August 2026, right?
Yeah, August 2026 by Dr. Bechara Sahili. It's titled The Dynamic Architecture of Viability.
Such a great title.
It really is. And when I say transdisciplinary, I mean I'm talking about a framework that attempts to act as a literal theory of everything.
Which is usually a red flag for me, honestly.
Right. Because the catch with those grand theories is they usually just reduce us to a bunch of atoms bouncing around in a meaningless void.
The classic trap of scientific reductionism.
Exactly. But this one actually attempts to explain why things matter.
And that avoidance of reductionism is really what makes this research so compelling to me. Because reductionism strips away the richness of human experience.
Yeah, our subjective feelings, our social bonds.
All of it. It replaces consciousness with this cold, third-person description of mechanical parts. But this framework refuses to do that.
But it also doesn't veer into like vague mysticism either.
No, not at all. It demands absolute, strict scientific and mathematical discipline.
Yeah, it's wild. It attempts to decode a grand synthesis, combining the physics of energy, evolutionary biology, subjective feelings, societal collapse.
Exceptional eight-dimensional mathematics.
Oh man, the math, and even the concept of love, all into one unified closed-loop system.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. So if you're listening, you might be wondering how we could possibly get from the physics of a cell to the concept of love using math.
It sounds like a huge leap.
It does. But the bridge to get there is exactly what we're going to build today. We're going to start at the very spark of life, looking at boundaries and energy.
Right, the foundations.
Then we'll map out this seven-part grammar of survival. After that, we tackle this massive philosophical pothole about how a biological machine actually gains conscious feeling.
The hard problem of consciousness.
Exactly. Then we scale all the way up to societal and planetary collapse, climb that ladder of mind-bending exceptional math, and finally arrive at why survival of the fittest is actually structurally inferior to what this text calls the biology of love.
It's a hell of a roadmap. But before we can understand how these complex systems maintain their viability over time, we have to understand how they emerge in the first place.
Right, how they begin.
Yeah. According to this framework, before you have a system, before you have life, you have a very simple fundamental act. It starts with drawing a line.
The first distinction. The
Exactly.
monograph cites George Spencer Brown here, right?
Yeah, the logician. He famously argued that to create any kind of form or understanding in the universe, you first have to draw a distinction.
You make a mark, and instantly you conjure an inside and an outside.
A boundary is the prerequisite for existence. But the offset emphasizes a really crucial philosophical point here. Drawing a distinction is a logical cognitive act.
It's usually performed by an observer.
Right. So if I take a marker and draw a circle on a whiteboard, and I label the inside the cell and the outside the environment,
that ink on the whiteboard isn't suddenly alive.
No, obviously not. And this invokes the work of the Chilean biologist Humberto Maturana. He has this concept of objectivity in parentheses.
I found that phrase so fascinating. Objectivity in parentheses.
It's a brilliant way to frame it.
Let's break that down for the listener, because it really challenges how most of us view reality.
It definitely does.
We usually think of objectivity as absolute truth, like no parentheses required.
We do. We tend to operate under the assumption that we are walking into a pre-existing, fully labeled universe.
Like reality is a cosmic grocery store.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, we think we just stroll down the aisles passively reading these objective tags that were already placed on the items.
But Maturana argues that is an illusion.
Completely. A world is brought forth through the specific operations of an observer. When we make distinctions, we are carving up reality based on our own biological and cultural architecture.
Right. I mean, obviously, we are constrained by an external physical reality.
Sure. We can't just imagine a wall isn't there and walk right through it.
Yeah, you'll still hit your head. But the specific categories, the boundaries, the labels we use, those are relational achievements. They depend on us actually doing the looking.
Exactly.
I see where this leads to a potential trap, though.
Oh.
Well, if boundaries require an observer to draw them, what was happening before human beings existed?
Right.
Like before we invented language to draw circles and invent categories, there were still living things. A bacterium 3 billion years ago didn't have language.
No, it didn't have a philosophy degree either.
Right, but it still knew to swim away from a toxic chemical. It maintained a boundary.
And that is why the text insists on what it calls domain discipline.
Domain discipline.
Yeah. It is incredibly easy to confuse the map with the territory. A physical difference in the environment, say, a gradient of acidity in a primordial pool is just a variation. But an operational discrimination occurs when a bounded system, like your bacterium, responds differently to that physical perturbation specifically because of its internal organization.
Oh, I see. So the bacterium isn't linguistically analyzing the water and declaring, warning, a toxin.
Exactly. It is operationally discriminating through its chemical structure. The trap we fall into is projecting human linguistic distinctions backward onto the simple cell.
We're doing the reverse, right?
Yeah.
Reducing complex human language to nothing more than mechanistic cellular reactions.
Yes, that's just as bad. Domain discipline means recognizing that the bacterium and the human are doing two fundamentally different kinds of boundary making.
Okay, that makes sense. So we have a boundary. An inside and an outside,
right.
Whether it's maintained operationally by a cell membrane or linguistically by a human concept.
Right.
But, like, a rock has a physical boundary. It has an inside and an outside.
Mm-hmm.
And a rock is decidedly not alive.
Definitely not.
To get life, we need energy. But this is where the paper throws a wrench into our standard assumptions. It argues that energy alone does not equal life or organization.
Because energy fundamentally is just the raw capacity to do work.
Right.
If you simply pump raw energy into a system, you don't get a beautifully organized cell or a thriving city. You usually just get heat, chaos, or total destruction.
Like an explosion. Massive energy, zero organization.
Exactly. Energy alone doesn't specify a form. It doesn't have a function, and it doesn't have a beneficiary. To extract organized, directed work out of raw energy, you must have constraint.
Man, this concept of constraint completely flipped my perspective.
It's powerful.
When I was reading this section, I immediately thought of the difference between like a raging flooded river and a hydroelectric turbine.
That's the perfect visualization.
Right, because a flooded river has a massive amount of kinetic energy, but it is just a chaotic, destructive flow.
Mm-hmm.
It dissipates heat. It violently erodes the riverbanks. It's just raw power.
Unbridled energy.
But when you build a hydroelectric dam, you introduce constraints. You build thick concrete walls. You install metal turbine blades set at very specific angles.
And those structures physically restrict what the water is allowed to do.
Exactly. They remove what the text calls degrees of freedom. And the paradox is, by restricting what the water cannot do, you channel that exact same kinetic energy into highly organized, incredibly useful work.
Like generating electricity to light up a city.
Exactly.
So that river and the turbine analogy perfectly illustrates Terence Deacon's concept of teleodynamics, which is central here.
Okay, break that down.
Well, in physics, a constraint is quite literally manifest by what does not occur. It is defined by absence.
Wow. Defined by absence.
Yeah. The concrete wall of your dam is a constraint because it represents the absence of the water's freedom to flow in that direction.
Right.
But in living biological systems, these constraints do something magical. They become recursive. The processes that are enabled by the constraints end up generating and repairing the very constraints themselves.
The constraints build the constraints.
Yeah.
That is a mind-bending loop.
Let's ground it in biology to make it clearer. Think of the membrane of a living cell.
Okay.
The cell membrane is a physical constraint. It severely restricts what molecules can flow in and out. By restricting that flow, it channels chemical energy to allow highly specific metabolic processes to occur inside the cell.
Right, the metabolism.
And what is the output of those metabolic processes? The synthesis of lipids and proteins that repair and maintain the cell membrane.
That is wild.
The system is recursively organized around its own self-maintenance. It's directed toward an end, its own ongoing survival, but that end isn't some mystical blueprint handed down from the sky.
Right, it's just physics and biology playing out.
It is an imminent norm that emerges spontaneously from this closed loop of constraints. It's autopoiesis, self-creation.
It's literally pulling itself up by its own structural bootstraps.
That's exactly.
Now, while we are on the topic of energy and constraints, there is a section in the monograph that meticulously untangles a concept that gets butchered constantly in pop science.
Oh, you mean free energy?
Yes. People throw that term around to sound smart, but this text strictly delineates three distinct types of free energy.
And if we don't separate them, the whole framework collapses.
Conflating them causes massive theoretical confusion, so we need to be incredibly precise here for you listening.
Okay, let's go through them. The first type is thermodynamic free energy. This is what we were just talking about with your hydroelectric turbine and the cell's metabolism.
Right, the literal physical energy available in an environment to do actual work.
It's the chemical bonds in your food, the kinetic force of the water.
The physical juice. The calories, the joules.
Exactly. Now, the second type is variational free energy. This stems from the neuroscientist Carl Friston's work on the free energy principle.
Which has absolutely nothing to do with physical calories or electricity, right?
Nothing at all. It is strictly an information theoretic concept. It describes how a system bounds or minimizes surprisal by constantly updating its probabilistic internal model of the external world.
Okay, in plain terms, what does that mean?
A system is always trying to minimize the difference between what it predicts will happen and the sensory data it actually receives.
Okay. Let me try to put a real-world mechanism to that. Imagine you are walking down a flight of stairs in the pitch dark.
A great example.
Your brain has a probabilistic model of those stairs based on your memory and, you know, the first few steps you took.
Yeah.
You predict that when you lower your foot, you will hit a solid wooden step exactly 8 inches down.
Right.
But let's say you miscalculated and you were actually at the bottom of the staircase. You lower your foot, expecting resistance, and you hit nothing but air.
And your foot smashes into the flat floor jarringly.
Yes. In that fraction of a second, your variational free energy absolutely spikes.
Because the sensory data you received wildly violated your internal prediction.
You experienced a massive prediction error or surprisal, and your brain instantly updates its model to realize you are on the ground floor.
That is exactly the mechanism. By minimizing those prediction errors over time, a system manages to stay within its characteristic survivable states rather than wandering into lethal surprises.
Okay, so what's the third type?
The third is expected free energy. This concept is utilized within the framework of active inference. It's how a system evaluates future potential policies or actions.
So it's looking ahead.
Yes. It calculates a balance between the system's preferences, like the states it biologically needs or wants to be in, and the potential information gain, which is the reduction of future uncertainty.
Okay, taking the stairs example again. If I am at the top of the dark stairs, I have a preference not to fall and break my neck.
A strong preference, ideally.
Right, so my expected free energy calculation might lead me to reach out and slide my hand along the wall before I take a step.
Exactly. You are taking an action to actively gather information.
Feeling for the wall to reduce my uncertainty about the environment.
Which keeps you aligned with your preference for survival. When you synthesize these ideas, you get a really profound picture of viability. Terence Deacon's teleodynamics explains the what.
the recursively regenerated physical constraints that give a system its boundary and allow it to capture thermodynamic free energy.
Yes. And Carl Friston's principles explain the how that bounded self-creating system navigates a chaotic universe by processing information, anticipating the future, and minimizing fatal surprises.
But this triggers a major philosophical alarm bell for me.
Uh-oh.
Well, if a single biological cell has a boundary, recursively regenerates its membrane using thermodynamic energy, and minimizes its variational free energy by swimming toward food and away from toxins, is it thinking? Is it predicting? Because the language of active inference makes it sound like the cell is doing calculus.
And this brings us right back to the absolute necessity of domain discipline. The cell is not performing conscious calculus.
Right.
Nor is it sitting there having a philosophical debate about its future. The math of expected free energy perfectly describes the cell's behavioral trajectory, but the cell itself is simply undergoing complex coupled chemical reactions.
So its predictions are just physically embodied in its structure.
Forged by millions of years of natural selection. It is surviving, it is viable, but it is not thinking in the linguistic, human sense of the word.
Which begs the question, if we have this beautifully bounded system, and it's using energy to maintain its constraints against a universe governed by entropy, what are the actual gears turning inside that system to keep it alive?
Because the universe is constantly throwing disturbances at it.
Exactly. How does it actually maintain viability? This text argues that there is a specific universal grammar.
A 7-part functional framework.
Yeah, that applies to literally any adaptive process in existence.
The equation at the heart of this framework is V equals C M X D P R O.
Okay, that's a lot of letters.
It is. These are the 7 irreducible functions of viability. And we must stress to the listener, these are not physical objects or biological substances.
You cannot put them under a microscope.
No, they are relational roles within a system.
Let's unpack the 7 gears of this machine. First, we have constraint, which is C. As we just discussed at length, this is whatever limits and organizes change within the system.
It could be the physical cell wall of a bacterium, the codified legal constitution of a nation, or the metabolic dependencies of an organ.
Next is margin, or M. This is arguably the most vital and frequently misunderstood component of the entire framework.
Absolutely.
Margin is the reserve. It is the literal or abstract distance you have from catastrophic failure.
In a human body, margin might be your metabolic reserve or your bone density. In a global banking system, margin is financial liquidity.
And in a marriage or a friendship, margin is the depth of accumulated trust.
That's a great way to look at it.
I want to spend a moment on margin because it feels like our modern, hyper-optimized society treats margin as an enemy.
Oh, completely.
We look at a factory with idle machines or a hospital with empty beds, and corporate consultants call it inefficient.
We view slack in a system as waste that must be eliminated to maximize profit.
But in this framework, margin isn't laziness. It is the ultimate biological shock absorber. If you optimize away all your margin, you are brittle.
And that brittleness is exactly what the framework diagnoses. Moving to the third function, we have state. Or X state is not just a static Polaroid snapshot of the system.
Right.
It captures the current configuration and the momentum or trajectory. Are you currently healthy but trending toward illness? Are you in debt but rapidly paying it off?
Fourth is disturbance D. This is the perturbation acting upon the system from the outside or even from within.
It is the thing threatening viability.
A mutated virus entering the bloodstream, a sudden massive hike in interest rates, or a bitter argument with a spouse.
Fifth is perception P. How are relevant differences in the environment or the internal state actually detected by the system?
Because a system can only react to what it can perceive, right?
Exactly. This could be a highly specialized chemical receptor on the surface of a T cell, or it could be the network of investigative journalists reporting on corruption within a democratic society.
If perception fails, you are flying blind. The disturbance is hitting you, but your dashboard says everything is fine.
Very dangerous.
Sixth is regulation R. This is the action the system takes to restore its viability in the face of the disturbance.
It is the physiological act of sweating to cool down a fever.
Or the legislative act of passing a new law to curb inflation.
Or the interpersonal act of offering a sincere apology to repair trust.
And finally, the 7th function is options O. These are the actionable, viable paths that are actually still open and available to the system, heavily dictated by its current constraints and the amount of margin it has left.
To help you visualize how these seven roles interact, think of the HUD, the heads-up display in a complex video game.
Oh, love this analogy.
Your state X is the glowing health bar in the corner of your screen. The disturbance, D, is the massive boss monster swinging a sword at your character. Your perception, P, is your literal ability as a player to see the animation of the attack winding up on your monitor. Your regulation, R, is your decision to hit the dodge roll button on your controller to avoid the damage.
But here is where the model clicks together. Margin, M, is your stamina bar. If you have been sprinting around and your stamina bar is at absolute zero, if you have no margin, you cannot execute the dodge roll.
It does not matter if you clearly perceive the attack coming.
Right. It doesn't matter if you frantically smash the regulation button. Because your margin is gone, your options, O, are instantly reduced to zero.
The fundamental constraints, C, of the game's programming dictate that without stamina, you take the hit, your state drops to zero, and the game is over.
That video game analogy brilliantly illustrates the interdependence of the variables. These seven functions do not operate in a simple linear assembly line. They co-belong.
And to demonstrate this, the author maps these seven variables into seven specific interlocking triads. These triads basically serve as a diagnostic manual for how complex systems fail.
I read the section on the triads, and it literally felt like reading the cheat codes to systemic collapse.
It's eerie how well it works.
It explains so much about why companies go under unexpectedly or why seemingly healthy people drop dead. Let's dig into these triads, rather than just listing them, because the mechanisms are fascinating.
Okay, let's start with the CMX triad. Constraint, margin, state. This triad defines the fundamental geometry of viability. The classic pathology here is hidden margin depletion.
Right.
Imagine a seemingly successful tech startup. On the outside, their state, X, looks phenomenal. They have a shiny office, their user numbers are up, the CEO is on magazine covers.
But internally, against the constraints, C, of their operating costs, they have been secretly burning through all their venture capital.
They have zero margin left. To the untrained eye, everything looks fine right up until a minor payroll delay bankrupts them overnight.
They look perfectly viable while standing one inch from the edge of a cliff.
It's the illusion of coherence.
Wow. What about the XDR triad? State, disturbance, regulation.
This is the response channel. System failure here manifests as a severe mismatch. It could be an overreaction, an underreaction, or a critically delayed response.
Like an autoimmune disease.
Exactly. The disturbance might be minor or non-existent, but the system's regulation goes into massive overdrive, attacking the body's own state. The regulation itself becomes the destructive force.
Or a delayed response, like putting on your seatbelt after the car has already crashed. The regulation is correct, but the sequence renders it useless.
Precisely.
Then there's the XPO triad. State, perception, options.
This defines perception possibility. When this triad breaks down, you see phenomena like learned helplessness or catastrophic tunnel vision.
Okay, how does that work?
A person might actually have several viable options available to improve their state. They could quit the toxic job, they could move to a new city. But because their perception is severely distorted by trauma, depression, or bad information, their option space artificially shrinks to nothing.
They remain trapped because they literally cannot perceive the open doors.
Exactly. And there are four other triads detailed in the text, adaptive capacity, which is MOR, pressure versus possibility, CDO, governance, CPR, and early warning, MDP.
But looking at this incredibly neat package of exactly seven variables forming exactly seven triads, my skeptical alarm goes off again.
Why is that?
Why seven? Did Dr. Saley just sit down and brainstorm until he get a lucky number? Or is there an underlying mathematical reason for this specific architecture?
The choice of seven is not arbitrary, and it is definitely not a coincidence. The author grounds this in finite geometry, specifically introducing the Fano plane.
The Fano plane.
The Fano plane is the smallest possible projective plane in mathematics. It consists of exactly seven points and exactly seven lines.
And that's significant because
the defining characteristic of the Fano plane is perfect, balanced, triadic closure. Every single point sits on exactly three lines, and every single line contains exactly three points. You can also derive the same structure from a specific binary vector space construction, F23.
But are we implying that a biological cell is consciously aware of binary math and projective geometry?
Not at all. The author is deeply careful here. Nature did not sit down with a chalkboard and design biological systems using F23 vector spaces.
Okay, good.
However, the text suggests something far more profound. If you want to construct the absolute minimal, complete, and logically robust grammar of how an adaptive system must relate to itself and to a hostile environment to survive, this 7-part mathematical geometry naturally emerges as the necessary skeleton.
It is the minimal viable geometry of survival.
Anything less, and the system lacks a necessary function and dies.
We're going to dive much deeper into that exceptional math later. But before we leave the mechanics of survival, we have to talk about innovation. How does a system invent new ways to survive?
Right.
The text introduces a concept called inverse Darwinism. And we need to unpack the how and why of this, because it challenges the standard cutthroat survival of the fittest narrative we are all taught in high school biology.
The traditional Darwinian view is incredibly harsh. The environment ruthlessly prunes the weak. Every trait must be relentlessly optimized for immediate survival, or the organism dies.
But there is a massive logical flaw there when it comes to complex innovation.
There is. If an organism is operating right on the razor's edge of survival, perfectly optimized with zero slack, any random genetic mutation is almost guaranteed to be fatal. It disrupts a highly tuned, brittle system.
So how do complex new organs or behaviors ever evolve? You can't just mutate half an eye and expect it to be useful immediately.
Exactly. Inverse Darwinism posits that it is redundancy, that supposedly inefficient margin we discussed earlier, that drives innovation.
Okay.
When an organism possesses generative margin, it is buffered from the immediate lethal pressures of the environment.
Because it is not constantly 1 second away from starvation or predation.
Right. Parts of its internal system actually have the structural breathing room to drift. They can experiment, they can interact in completely novel, unscripted ways, and they can discover new internal complementarities without the whole organism instantly dropping dead.
So evolution actively tolerates the massive thermodynamic cost of maintaining useless margin because the existential cost of running without it is certain death the moment the environment changes.
But that's exactly it.
It's like a company keeping a research and development department. The R&D department doesn't produce immediate daily profit, right? It consumes resources.
Yeah.
It is, strictly speaking, inefficient.
But if the market suddenly shifts...
That inefficient margin is the only thing that invents the new product that saves the company from bankruptcy.
A perfect translation of the concept, generative margin is the biological prerequisite for the discovery of new options.
Okay, so we have now mapped out this incredible functional robot. It has boundaries, it captures energy, it maintains its constraints, and it regulates itself using a flawless 7-part mathematical grammar.
Yeah.
It even has margin to innovate. But here is the massive philosophical pothole I mentioned earlier. We are not just robots.
No, we are not.
A thermostat regulates its state, but a thermostat does not feel cold. We humans feel things. We experience the vibrant redness of an apple, the searing, agonizing sting of a physical burn, the profound, chest-aching grief of losing a loved one.
The subjective experience.
How does a mechanical, biological system suddenly spark into subjective conscious experience?
You have just walked us right up to the edge of the hard problem of consciousness. And Dr. Safley tackles this through a philosophical framework he terms triune aspect process monism.
That's a dense string of words. Let's take that apart piece by piece.
It sounds intimidating, but the underlying logic is incredibly elegant. First, it completely rejects material reductionism.
The idea that humans are nothing more than meat machines and that consciousness is just an illusion generated by physical brain meat.
Exactly. But equally, it rejects dualism, the idea proposed by Descartes, that the mind is some ethereal, ghostly substance floating around entirely separate from the physical body.
Okay, so what does it propose instead?
It proposes monism. There is only one underlying relational process happening. But this single process has three irreducible aspects or windows through which it can be accessed or known.
So one underlying reality, three different windows to look through. What are the windows?
The first is the first-person window, the intrinsic domain. This is the I. It is the domain of felt significance. It is quite literally what it feels like to be the system from the inside.
Okay, that's clear.
The second is the second person window, the participatory domain. This is the you or the we. It is the realm of mutual address, co-regulation, empathy, shared language, and trust. It is what happens organically between subjects.
And the third?
The third is the third person window, the extrinsic domain. This is the it. It is the publicly describable, measurable physical structure. This is the traditional domain of standard science where we measure brainwaves, heart rates, and chemical gradients.
The text mentions Ken Wilber's equal framework as a conceptual map for this. The idea that every occasion has an interior and an exterior, an individual and a collective aspect.
Yes, very similar structure.
It means you absolutely cannot fully understand a human being just by dissecting their brain chemistry, the it window. You also have to know the content of their personal feelings, the I window. And you have to understand how they are embedded in their culture and relationships, the we window.
If you ignore any of the three windows, your science is fundamentally incomplete.
And applying this triune aspect view leads us directly to the text's metaphysical identity hypothesis, which answers your question about why we feel pain.
Oh, this part is fascinating.
In this framework, conscious emotion is not a useless accidental byproduct of cognition. It isn't just noise in the machine. Emotion is what the author brilliantly terms affective compression.
Compression of what? How does that work mechanically?
Well, think about the staggering amount of data your body is processing when you step on a sharp nail. Your nervous system is tracking local tissue damage, inflammatory chemical cascades, a sudden drop in metabolic efficiency, the specific geometric location of the injury on your foot.
The spatial urgency of the threat, your hippocampal memory of previous injuries, all simultaneously.
Yes. If your brain tried to present all of those thousands of individual data points to your conscious awareness as a spreadsheet, you would be paralyzed by information overload.
And the predator would eat you.
Exactly. Affective compression integrates that massively high-dimensional array of physiological data into one globally available, instantly actionable state.
Hmm.
The feeling of searing pain. The pain is the compression.
So the hypothesis is that the subjective first-person feeling of pain and the objective third-person biological integration of all those regulatory signals are quite literally the exact same thing, just being viewed through two different windows of reality.
Exactly. And this forces a radical shift in how we approach neuroscience. For decades, pop science has told us that the hippocampus, or the amygdala, is the center of emotion.
Right. You hear that everywhere.
But this paper clarifies the anatomy. The hippocampus provides relational memory and contextual mapping. But core affect the raw, undeniable reality of feeling relies on much deeper, ancient, highly distributed networks. The brainstem, the hypothalamus, and the interoceptive networks that map the internal state of the visceral body.
You don't just feel with your highly evolved cerebral cortex. You feel with your entire integrated metabolic organism.
Which brings up a fascinating theoretical contrast in the text. It compares this framework with analytic idealism, a philosophy heavily associated with thinkers like Bernardo Kastrup.
Oh, interesting.
From what I understand, Kastrup solves the hard problem of consciousness by starting from the opposite end. He says the universal consciousness is the only fundamental reality, and you, me, and the table are all just dissociated alters or localized dreams of that one universal mind.
Analytic idealism is incredibly popular right now because it neatly sidesteps the problem of how dead matter creates consciousness by simply declaring that dead matter doesn't exist.
Right.
But Dr. Saheeli's framework is much more rigorous and biologically grounded. It doesn't deny that primitive matter might possess some microscopic, unimaginable experiential aspect, a sort of panpsychism.
Sure.
But it argues forcefully that the unified felt concern we experience, a true subjective I that cares about its own survival, requires a very specific biological and thermodynamic threshold to be crossed.
And this is where I have to push back and test the limits of this theory.
Go for it.
If feeling is just integrated regulation and effective compression of data, as we just defined it,
mm-hmm.
What about artificial intelligence?
The AI question.
Imagine a highly advanced citywide smart grid AI. It monitors its own electrical state. It perceives spikes in temperature. It regulates its cooling fans. It anticipates server loads using expected free energy.
It has boundaries. It has the 7-part grammar.
Exactly. So does the smart grid feel? Does a complex AI have a first-person window?
That is the ultimate frontier question of our time. And this is why the biological concept of autopoietic closure from our first section is the non-negotiable linchpin of this entire theory.
Right. Self-creation.
A smart grid, or even the most advanced current AI, does not recursively produce the physical thermodynamic constraints that constitute its own boundaries. We, the human engineers, built the server racks. We plug the AI into the power grid.
Okay, so its regulation and data compression are vastly impressive, yes.
But it lacks teleodynamic closure. It is not self-producing its own physical flesh from the ground up against the constant threat of entropy.
So because it isn't literally building its own body out of raw materials to stave off its own death, it lacks that imminent norm. It has no intrinsic stakes.
Precisely. In this framework, that fragile metabolic self-production, the absolute necessity of keeping yourself alive at the thermodynamic level, is the prerequisite for an immanent norm.
And that immanent norm is the prerequisite for true subjective biological feeling.
Yes. Until an AI physically metabolizes and repairs its own hardware to prevent its own physical dissolution, it remains a brilliant simulation, lacking the first-person window of felt significance.
That is incredibly clarifying. Feeling is anchored in the literal flesh-and-blood vulnerability of needing to survive.
Beautifully put.
So, having established how this works in a single, conscious, biological body, we have to ask, what does all this mean when we scale it up? If this seven-part grammar and these three windows apply to a single organism, how do they apply to massive collectives like a society or a global economy or a planetary ecosystem?
This brings us to the macro level, scaling up.
To scale up, the monograph introduces the concept of cross-scale circulation. The fundamental idea is that viability is not just horizontal, it is vertical.
There is a continuous reciprocal loop between the micro-level actors and the macro-level structures.
Right. Conditions flow downward from the macro. Planetary climate shifts, massive economic institutions, historical cultural norms. These act as giant overarching constraints on the options of individual human bodies.
But simultaneously, embodied actions flow upward. Individuals interact, they build trust, they vote, they create new laws.
Those millions of micro actions crystallize and solidify into the very macro institutions that will constrain the next generation.
It is a massive, multi-generational feedback loop. But as we know from history, loops can become pathological.
Yeah. The paper describes a horrifying mechanism called loop entrapment. This occurs when a subsystem within the larger whole, say, a massive monopolistic corporation, or functionally, a literal malignant tumor inside a human body, figures out how to survive by aggressively extracting all the generative margin from the larger system around it.
The subsystem looks incredibly viable, wealthy, and highly coherent, but it is actually a parasite. It is systematically destroying the life support system of its host.
And to prove that this framework isn't just an abstract philosophical thought experiment, Dr. Seelig puts his seven-part grammar to a brutal test.
He takes four incredibly distinct real-world crises.
A medical emergency, an ecological disaster, an economic collapse, and a geopolitical war.
Mm.
And he maps the exact same V equals C, MX, D, P, R, O grammar onto all of them to prove its universality.
I want to spend significant time on these four stress tests because this is where the theory hits the pavement.
Let's do it. Let's look at case number one, a medical crisis. Specifically, septic shock.
Septic shock is a terrifying condition, often misunderstood by the public as simply an infection that causes dangerously low blood pressure.
Right.
But mapping it through our grammar reveals that it is a cascading multi-system relational failure. First, it is a catastrophic failure of the XDR triad, state disturbance regulation.
The disturbance is the bacterial infection.
Yes. But the body's immune regulation completely loses its signal fidelity. It becomes wildly mismatched to the disturbance, launching a massive, unregulated inflammatory response known as a cytokine storm. The regulation itself begins destroying the body's own tissues.
The defense mechanism becomes the weapon.
Exactly. But it is also a lethal failure of the CMX triad, constraint margin state. Imagine a patient in the ICU. Their blood pressure monitor their state. X might look perfectly stable and normal. The doctor might think they are fine.
But that normal state is an illusion.
Because the patient is being pumped full of massive doses of chemical vasopressors, they have entirely exhausted their intrinsic physiological margin against the constraints of their failing organs.
They are operating on zero biological stamina.
Because they have no margin, one tiny further disturbance, a slight shift in temperature, a minor secondary infection, and the entire system collapses instantly. The normal state hid the depleted margin.
Wow. That perfectly mirrors the tech startup bankruptcy we discussed earlier, just in human flesh.
It really does.
Let's move to case two, an ecological crisis. Coral reef bleaching. We're jumping from human blood vessels to the ocean floor.
And the translation is seamless. For a coral reef, margin is not blood pressure. It is the genetic diversity of the coral polyps, their built-in thermal tolerance, and the geographic connectedness of cool water refuges.
The disturbance is the increasing frequency of marine heat anomalies due to climate change.
But the most insightful part of this analysis is how human economic systems disastrously overlap with the ecological system through a mechanism called proxy capture.
Proxy capture. How does that work in a reef?
Imagine a highly industrialized local fishing or coastal tourism economy operating on the reef. internally, that human economy might look perfectly regulated and highly viable.
The boats are efficient, the profits are high, the state of the local GDP is booming.
But it achieves that internal coherence by relentlessly depleting the reef's biological margin, overfishing the keystone species that clean the coral, polluting the water.
So the human economy is capturing proxies, measuring viability entirely in abstract dollars while completely ignoring the fact that it is systemically dismantling the physical life support constraints of the ocean that generate those dollars in the first place.
When the heat wave hits, the reef has no margin left to adapt, and it bleaches and dies, taking the human economy down with it.
Proxy capture. We mistake the map, which is money, for the territory, which is the physical earth. This leads brilliantly into case three, a pure economic crisis. The financial system. Specifically looking at the mechanics of the 2008 global financial crash.
In a global financial system, what constitutes margin? It is liquidity, it is capital buffers, but fundamentally, above all else, it is relational trust.
Trust is margin.
Yes. Before a catastrophic crash like 2008, you typically see the hyperfinancialization of the market and massive leveraging silently eroding that foundational margin. Financial institutions become deeply entangled in an XPO failure. State perception options.
Walk us through how the perception failed in 2008 using the grammar.
Well, the banks and rating agencies were using proxy metrics like the constantly rising housing prices and AAA ratings on complex collateralized debt obligations to perceive their internal state as infinitely healthy and profitable.
Because their perception was completely distorted by these faulty models, they suppressed or ignored all the real-world data about the underlying toxicity of the subprime mortgages.
They thought they had vast options, but when the disturbance finally hit the inevitable wave of actual homeowner defaults, the illusion shattered.
Their option space narrowed instantly to zero. Because they had leveraged away all their liquidity, there was no margin left to absorb the shock.
The entire global system froze because the trust evaporated.
Three entirely different domains, medicine, ecology, economics, and the exact same geometric collapse of margin and perception.
It's all the same underlying architecture.
Now, we arrive at case four, and I want to set a very strict boundary here for you listening. This case addresses a highly charged geopolitical crisis. The U.S.-Israel-Iran conflict system.
This is a sensitive one.
Very. And the monograph utilizes this conflict strictly as a structural mathematical problem of system dynamics. We're going to analyze this purely through the lens of the viability grammar. We are looking at the mechanics of how systems universally entrap themselves, examining the feedback loops without endorsing or analyzing the specific political ideologies of any actor involved.
That is the only way to utilize the framework effectively here. When you view a multi-state conflict purely as a structural system, what emerges is the terrifying reality of a self-confirming XDR loop, state disturbance regulation.
On a massive scale.
Let's map it out. Nation A perceives a threat and takes a military or strategic action intended purely as internal regulation, perhaps increasing its armaments, securing borders, or launching a preemptive strike.
The goal is to stabilize its own security state.
However, because these nations share the same enclosed geopolitical environment, that very act of regulation by Nation A is structurally perceived by Nation B as a severe aggressive disturbance.
So Nation B is perturbed, and it has to restore its own viability. So Nation B responds with its own severe regulation, a counterstrike or a blockade, which Nation A immediately perceives as a brand new unprovoked disturbance.
And the snare pulls tight. It forms a perfectly locked escalatory feedback loop. In this hyper-reactive environment, the crucial element of margin, which in international geopolitics consists of back-channel diplomacy, historical goodwill, and verifiable communication channels, is completely incinerated.
Once that relational trust is gone, the perception function of both nations becomes overwhelmingly filtered through worst-case threat anticipation.
When an intelligence apparatus can only perceive existential threat, the diplomatic options artificially and rapidly narrow. Leaders on both sides feel entirely forced into taking extreme kinetic actions because they literally cannot perceive any viable, safe diplomatic paths remaining.
The geometry of their reality is shrunk. Every move feels absolutely forced by the previous move of the adversary.
It is the ultimate tragedy of loop entrapment. The system regulates itself right off a cliff.
Looking across all four of those massively different domains, the septic patient, the bleaching coral, the crashing banks, and the escalating war, Dr. Safili distills a universal pattern. He identifies a triad of collapse, three specific pillars that fundamentally fail across the board right before a system dies.
First, signal fidelity. Do you have access to truthful, unfiltered feedback about your environment? Or are your sensors heavily distorted by proxies, inflammation, or propaganda?
Second, trust. The relational margin. Do the parts of the system still communicate and share resources, or have they turned parasitic?
Third, optionality. The actual geometry of viable paths available to navigate around a disturbance.
It is a profound diagnostic tool. If a biological or social system loses its access to truth, exhausts its relational trust, and artificially collapses its options, it is in a state of advanced terminal relational collapse.
It does not matter if the headline indicators like a soaring stock market index, a politician's approval rating, or a patient's artificially sustained blood pressure look perfectly fine.
The collapse is already mathematically baked into the system. It is just waiting for the final disturbance.
It makes me think of a pilot flying a commercial jet into a severe storm.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
If your cockpit dashboard gives you faulty data about your altitude, that is a fatal loss of signal fidelity.
If you are screaming at your co-pilot and refuse to coordinate with them, that is a fatal loss of trust.
And if you only have enough fuel left to fly in a straight line, meaning you cannot divert to another airport, that is a total loss of optionality. It does not matter how shiny the plane is, you are going to crash.
Man, this grounded, real-world analysis is brilliant. But strap in, because here's where the monograph takes a sharp, vertical turn into the stratosphere.
Here comes the math.
We have seen the seven functions operate in the messy real world. But Dr. Sahali takes this grammar and runs it up a ladder of pure, exceptional mathematics. Why? Because he is searching for the fundamental geometric shape of survival itself.
We have to tread with extreme philosophical caution here, because when you mix consciousness, biology, and high-dimensional math, it is incredibly easy to veer off into New Age mysticism.
Oh, yeah.
The text maps a rigorous mathematical progression that climbs from grammar to algebra to geometry and finally to dynamics. We already established the starting point. The Fano plane, our minimal geometry of 7 points and 7 lines.
Right.
But if you take those static lines and you assign them a specific direction, an arrow of time or action, you step out of basic geometry and into the bizarre algebraic world of the Octonians.
Okay, I'm going to need you to hold my hand here. I barely passed high school calculus. What on earth is an Octonian and why does a biologist care about it?
The Octonians form an eight-dimensional number system. It is one of the only four normed division algebras that can mathematically exist in our universe, alongside real numbers, complex numbers, and quaternions.
Okay.
But the defining critical feature of Octonians for our framework of survival is that their mathematics is strictly non-associative.
Break down non-associative for me.
In the normal, everyday math we use to balance a checkbook, grouping does not matter. The equation A plus B, grouped together, plus C, will always give you the exact same result as A plus the group of B plus C. You can move the parentheses around, and the reality of the number stays the same.
Right.
But in the non-associative math of the Octonians, the order and grouping of operations fundamentally alter the final reality. Doing action A, combining it with B, and then introducing C yields a totally different systemic state than doing C and B first, and then introducing A.
Oh, I see. It maps exactly to real-world causality.
Yes.
Sequence and context change reality.
Exactly.
Let's apply that to the 2008 financial crisis we just talked about. If the government bails out a bank action A, and then the bank changes its lending rules action B, and then a recession hits action C, the resulting state of the economy is completely different than if the recession hits first, the bank changes its rules in a panic, and then the government tries a bailout.
The ingredients are identical, but the sequence changes the survival outcome.
That is a phenomenal application of the concept. Context dependence is a fundamental law of biological and social nature.
Octonionic math provides the only rigorous formal algebraic structure where the sequence, grouping, and historical context of actions inherently matter to the final equation. And the mathematical ladder in the text continues upward from there. It climbs through increasingly complex, beautifully symmetric structures, spin-innate triality, G2 automorphism groups, up into Freudenthal triple systems.
I have to pause you on Freudenthal triple systems. Give me an intuitive sense of what that mechanism is doing in this context, without the chalkboard equations.
Think of a Freudenthal triple system as a mathematical loom that weaves together multiple intersecting triad relationships simultaneously. In our survival grammar, a system isn't just dealing with one triad, like state disturbance regulation in isolation.
It is simultaneously managing its perception options and its constraint margin.
The Freudenthal math models how these different triangular relationships interact and balance each other without tearing the fabric of the system apart. And this entire mathematical ascent eventually culminates in E8, which is a massive, exceptionally beautiful 248-dimensional symmetry group that physicists often use in string theory to attempt to unify the fundamental forces of the universe.
Okay, wait. I'm going to throw a massive flag on the play here.
I knew this was coming.
I am pushing back hard.
Yeah.
Are we seriously suggesting that a human immune system fighting off a bacterial cytokine storm or a frantic diplomat trying to negotiate a ceasefire in the Middle East is literally sitting there crunching eight-dimensional octonionic mass and 248-dimensional EA symmetries? Because that sounds exactly like Deepak Chopra-level quantum mysticism to me.
And Dr. Savely would entirely agree with your skepticism. He explicitly warns against what he calls mathematical literalism. This is a vital caveat in the
I'm
monograph.
good.
The mathematics of E8, or the Octonians, are exact and pristine within their own Platonic domain. But taking those pristine equations and projecting them directly onto the messy, wet biology of a cell, or the chaotic sociology of a war, is a bridge hypothesis. And bridge hypotheses can fail. The mathematics here is utilized as a disciplined third look.
A disciplined third look,
Yeah?
meaning it's a topological mirror.
Exactly. It maps structural coherences. The math shows us that reality, at its most fundamental level, seems to favor deeply balanced, mathematically symmetric constraints for long-term stability. But E8 is not presented as the maximal magical structure of everyday reality. It is simply the furthest logical endpoint of a specific mathematical ladder that we built to help our limited human brains visualize incredibly complex, context-dependent, multidimensional relationships.
Phew. Okay. That brings me back down to earth.
Yeah.
So the math is an ultra-high-definition diagnostic model to help us spot when real-world systems are losing their symmetry and breaking down. And from this deep mathematical dive, the author extracts two highly practical theoretical tools. He calls them the altimeter and the Wu-wave vector. Let's unpack the altimeter first.
The altimeter is proposed as a theoretical high-dimensional dashboard for researchers and policymakers. The goal of the altimeter is to track the global relational condition of a complex system, specifically to measure the hidden loss of margin and optionality long before the local conventional proxy variables crash.
It is trying to detect that systemic hidden brittleness we saw in the septic shock patient or the 2008 banks, providing a true early warning system before the catastrophic phase transition occurs.
Like a dashboard that actually shows your stamina bar, not just your health bar.
And what about the Wu-wei vector? Wu-wei is an ancient Taoist concept, right?
Yeah.
It translates roughly to non-action or effortless action.
Yes. In the geometric space of system dynamics, the Wu-wei vector represents the precise direction of the least forcing intervention. When a complex system is trapped in a pathological loop, like our geopolitical conflict, heavy-handed, top-down, massive control interventions almost always make the situation worse because they consume massive amounts of the system's remaining margin to enforce. The Wu-wei vector is about finding the absolute smallest, structurally precise change that unblocks the system's own internal capacity for self-regulation.
It makes me think of the concept of a keystone and a massive stone archway. If the archway is unstable, you don't need 100 bulldozers to smash the walls back into place that's maximum forcing.
Right.
If you understand the geometry of the arch, you just tap the one specific keystone at the top. You apply a tiny vector of force, and the entire massive architecture of the system suddenly locks into a stable, viable state using its own weight. You unblock its options without imposing heavy-handed domination.
The keystone is a brilliant visualization of the Wu-wei vector. You aren't forcing the river. You are just removing the one strategic log that caused the dam.
I love that. Which brings us to the ultimate final hurdle of this deep dive. We have reached section six of the author's argument, the ultimate test.
The value test.
Here is the massive ethical problem with everything we've discussed so far. A system can be perfectly mathematically viable according to the seven-part grammar. It can have high margin, pristine perception, and incredible optionality. But it can still be an absolute horrifying nightmare.
A brutal totalitarian regime with a perfect surveillance state and an unbeatable army is highly viable.
A deadly, fast-spreading cancer can be highly viable for a time. So if viability isn't enough, how do we judge if a system actually should survive? We need a value test.
This is exactly where pure cold systems theory hits a wall. Systems theory can tell you how a machine survives, but it cannot tell you if the machine is good or evil. To solve this, the monograph introduces the philosopher John McMurtry's life value ontology.
Okay, what is that?
The core principle is beautifully simple, but incredibly demanding. An organization or a system is only truly life coherent if it protects, enables, or enlarges life capacity without transferring disabling, destructive costs to other lives or to future generations.
It's the ultimate anti-parasite test.
Precisely. Let's look at a multinational corporation. If that corporation ensures its own high viability and profit margins by legally dumping toxic chemicals into a local river, it is transferring the massive cost of disease and ecological death onto the local community.
By McMurtry's standard, the corporation fails the life value test completely. It is highly viable in isolation, but is deeply life incoherent in the whole.
If a powerful nation maintains its internal economic peace and high standard of living by violently exploiting the natural resources of a poorer nation, it fails the test. True life coherence requires that your local viability does not demand the systemic destruction of your neighbor's viability.
And this framework gives a specific name to this structural mechanism that actually allows a system to pass this test. And I warn you, the word it uses is going to sound surprisingly unscientific and soft at first.
The word is love.
Specifically, returning to Humberto Maturana, the biology of love.
When hard scientists hear the word love in a theoretical paper, they instinctively flinch. But Maturana defined love with absolute rigorous precision. He defined it as the emotioning in which the other arises as a legitimate other in coexistence.
A legitimate other in coexistence. Let's translate that. That doesn't mean you have to feel warm, fuzzy, romantic feelings about them.
No, it has nothing to do with romance. It means you structurally recognize their fundamental right to exist. You recognize their right to have their own boundary, their own generative margin, their own valid first-person window of experience.
In this transdisciplinary framework, love is not a sentiment. It functions structurally. It acts mathematically as relational generative margin.
Relational generative margin. Wait, so it acts like inverse Darwinism, but for society.
You've connected the dots perfectly. Think back to inverse Darwinism. Just as biological redundancy and extra margin protect a primitive cell from immediate death so it has the breathing room to learn and adapt, love protects complex relationships and entire societies from the premature, violent elimination of difference.
When you encounter someone or something you profoundly disagree with, the Darwinian reflex is to eliminate the disturbance to protect your state.
Love structurally suspends that lethal reflex. It stops us from immediately destroying what we do not understand. It provides the system with the invaluable time and relational space required to learn, to adapt, and to eventually discover new, non-destructive complementarities.
That is profound. Love is the structural shock absorber of society. And the author takes this one massive step further into speculation, correlating this entirely scientific biological framework with ancient theology.
Specifically, he maps it onto the biblical greatest commandment, love God, love your neighbor, and love yourself.
And if you look closely, watch how flawlessly that ancient commandment maps onto the three windows of reality we discussed earlier.
Yes, let's lay that map out. Love yourself. That preserves your intrinsic boundary. It honors the first-person window, the I. It mathematically acknowledges that your viability matters. You are not just a resource meant to be consumed by the collective.
Love your neighbor. That pries open the participatory domain, the second-person window. It recognizes the other person as a legitimate subject in coexistence, generating the relational margin we just talked about.
And love God, or love the ultimate source. That macro orientation points the whole system toward the ultimate overarching life ground. It acts as the ultimate constraint that prevents any local subsystem like a greedy corporation, a tyrannical nation, or a runaway AI from declaring itself the ultimate authority and becoming a deadly parasite on the whole of creation.
It is a breathtaking synthesis of human knowledge. It suggests that teachings we have historically viewed as purely moral, religious, or spiritual, like the parable of the Good Samaritan intentionally breaking down hostile tribal identities, or the ancient concept of the Sabbath providing a mandatory, codified day of rest, are not just nice ethical ideas.
They can be seen as phenomenologically tested, structurally necessary orientations for long-term relational viability.
The Sabbath is literally the institutional legal protection of margin. It prevents the total thermodynamic extraction of the human being by the economic system.
Exactly. In this transdisciplinary framework, love is not just a poetic sentiment to put on a greeting card. It is the ultimate systemic metric that, as the author states, judges the conservation. It looks at the beautifully balanced equations of the Octonians and the seven-part grammar and asks the final unavoidable question. What kind of world are you actually maintaining with all this viability?
Okay, let's take a deep breath and look back at the incredible territory we have covered today.
We started at the absolute beginning, with the basic physics of drawing a boundary and channeling chaotic energy into organized constraints.
We mapped out the 7 functions of a Fano plane constraint: margin, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options.
We bridged the gap into the subjective feeling of being alive, defining consciousness as the effective compression of survival data.
We analyzed the terrifying, cascading crashes of global systems when they lose their truth, their trust, and their optionality.
We climbed an 8-dimensional math ladder to find the geometry of least resistance, the Wu-Wei vector. And we discovered that, structurally and scientifically, the concept of love is the ultimate mechanism for sustainable survival.
It is a framework that absolutely refuses to leave anything out. It demands that we coordinate the cold physics of energy, the messy biology of evolution, the deep psychology of trauma, the pristine mathematics of geometry, and the profound ethics of life value without ever reducing any one of those domains to the other.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, sitting in your car or walking your dog right now? Do not just leave this as some abstract academic theory. Look at your own life through the lens of this grammar.
Look at your job, your physical body, your marriage, your friendships. Where is your margin?
Are you running on absolutely zero stamina, secretly hiding a massive depletion from the world while trying to maintain the illusion of a perfect state?
Are you trusting the right signals, or is your perception dashboard feeding you distorted proxy metrics?
Are you trapped in an XDR loop, constantly overreacting to minor disturbances until your options vanish entirely?
Think about your personal Wu-Wei vector. What is the smallest, most precise, least forcing change you can make today, tapping the keystone to regain your optionality and breathe life back into your system?
And I would leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over, returning to the very first concept we discussed on our journey. We talked about how an observer brings forth a world by making distinctions and drawing boundaries.
If our subjective feelings and our linguistic distinctions quite literally generate the boundaries of our shared physical reality, then the words we use to describe each other today in our politics and our culture are not just passive descriptions.
They are the literal physical constraints of the world we are forcing our children to survive in tomorrow. We are building the architecture of the future with our language.
So the ultimate question is, are we building a grammar of entrapment, or are we building a grammar of love?
Usually when we talk about a diagnosis, whether it is for a failing human body or a fracturing society, we expect the crisp, black and white precision of an X-ray. But Dr. Sekely's framework shows us that viability is a complex, dynamic, and deeply relational landscape. It is murky, it is messy, but it is beautifully interconnected from the smallest cell to the largest galaxy. And perhaps, armed with the right grammar, we can finally learn how to navigate it together.